Hello, I am Cindy, and together with Terry.
Hello.
And our special guests, we have a podcast series that looks at some important issues within healthcare. Our new series on substance use disorder reviews different treatment options in the U.S. with the goal to help motivate the many millions of individuals in need of treatment to take the first step towards seeking that treatment and support. According to the 2021 National Survey on Drug Use and Health, among people aged 12 or older, about 44 million people needed substance use treatment over the year, while only about 1.5% of these individuals actually believed that they needed and sought treatment. Another 2% believed that treatment was needed, but they did not enroll, and 97% thought that treatment was not needed. So if you or your provider are unsure whether you are one of the millions of people with an addiction disorder, or if you are pretty certain that you do need treatment, please listen to the advice of medical and professional experts that we have as guests on our podcast series. And please think seriously about taking that first step toward recovery by asking yourself some tough questions or reaching out to our guests' organizations and directly asking them. Our episode today is entitled From Dependence to Independence, Addressing Depression and Substance Use Disorder Treatment, and features Dr. Linda Lang, president of Inova's Behavioral Health Services. Dr. Lang brings in-depth expertise to our discussion with insights into the intersection of mental health and substance use disorder. She has extensive experience in psychiatry, women's health, integrative medicine, and substance use disorders. She's the recipient of numerous awards and leadership roles to her credit, include as previous chairperson of the Department of Psychiatry Behavioral Health Service Line at Christiana Care in Delaware, and the Outstanding Teaching Award from the Robert Wood Johnson Medical School, among many other roles. Dr. Lang is board certified by the American Board of Psychiatry and is a member of the American Psychiatric Association. Under her leadership, the Inova Behavioral Health Services Department now focuses on supporting the total well-being, mind and body of each patient through a multidisciplinary team of psychiatrists, psychologists, nurses, therapists, social workers, and other behavioral health professionals. One example of these remarkable services is the screening of patients for depression upon their initial Inova care provider visit. An initial screening test with a few questions allows health professionals to detect and treat depression at an early stage and to assess the implication of depression with treatment for other ailments such as addiction. Welcome to our podcast, Dr. Lang.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for your service over many years across numerous communities and your interest in supporting patients and providers tackling some very complex mental health and substance use challenges. To start our discussion, it would be very helpful to our listeners if you could provide a brief overview of Inova's substance use treatment program and some of the key differences of that program over other treatment options.
Sure, I'd be happy to. So we call Inova's addiction treatment program CATS. It's known in the community as CATS, and that stands for Inova Comprehensive Addiction Treatment Service. So a lot of people know it as CATS. And what makes it outstanding from other programs is that it is comprehensive. So starting from the highest level of care, we have a detox unit, a medical detox unit at Fairfax Hospital, where we can manage people who are detoxing from opiates, alcohol, benzodiazepines, things like heroin, fentanyl, pain medications, and they're seen by physicians, nurse practitioners, physician assistants. We have 24/7 nursing monitoring. So that's usually a 3 to 7 day stay to get a person detoxed from whatever substance they're struggling with. And then from there, it doesn't stop. We, you know, if they're willing and they're ready, we recommend that they move into the next lower level of care, which is a partial hospital program or an intensive program. And those are outpatient The partial is 5 days a week, all day, and then the intensive outpatient is 3 days a week for half a day. So depending what their needs are. And then throughout the system, we've just started a peer recovery program. So the goal is to get a peer specialist in every emergency department. So we have five hospitals, we would have five peer specialists. So when people come into the emergency room, the goal is to really meet people at that moment when they come to the emergency department and encourage them through peer-to-peer conversation what that would be like if they took the next step and got some treatment, and to motivate people through the experience of someone who's been there, a peer. So we've just rolled that out. We also in the emergency department do something called ESPERT screening, and that stands for screening, brief intervention, and referral to treatment. So it's a series of questions. And through that, we can tell if somebody is ready to be referred to treatment. And that just kind of helps sort of drive those decisions. But there's lots of groups. We also look at remission. I mean, the hope is people will go into remission. We want people to stay in remission. So we have remission recovery groups as well. This is a lifelong struggle. I mean, when people go to 12-step programs, they know that they may be in remission, but they're always having to work on it. It's something that should be at top of mind. So we try to provide any door that somebody is ready to come through. We want to be able to provide that care.
Yes, that's very good. Given our focus is how do we get more into treatment and why are so many individuals left untreated for a whole host of reasons. But can you elaborate on the added challenges and the extra substance use treatment steps that a patient with a mental health diagnosis such as depression might face and how you approach that?
Yes. So that the term for that is co-occurring. Mm-hmm. So it would be the challenge of having co-occurring substance use disorder with a mental health disorder. So depression, bipolar disorder, ADHD, panic disorder, and then substance disorder. And the challenge is if you're suffering, for example, with anxiety or panic disorder, you might reach for something that's going to help that and self-medicate. Mm-hmm. And if people turn to a substance like, let's say, a benzodiazepine, you know, before long, there's going to be a substance use problem because of self-medicating this panic disorder. So they sort of become dependent on each other, and it's a little bit harder to overcome. One feeds off the other. Mm-hmm. We do treat that, of course, and we can treat both at the same time concurrently, which is best. We can use things like CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy. There's trauma treatment. There's collaborative care that we provide. So if somebody has both, we might bring people in who can do the counseling for substance and the peer counseling, and then bring our counselors and physicians in to treat a mental health disorder. But it's particularly prominent right now in adolescents, actually. And I recently saw a statistic that 60% of adolescents have co-occurring mental health and substance disorders. So the drugs of abuse start early in adolescence now. And so we're seeing that. Plus there's nicotine and vaping, which we consider also substance disorder. So yeah, that is a challenge for sure.
Yes. Very, very interesting. Once a patient is enrolled in a treatment program, what evidence do you look for that indicates the patient is in fact getting better?
So, you know, we use a sort of framework of motivation and motivational interviewing, motivational counseling. And motivation is really the key to changing behavior. It's not what I think it's or the timing that I want it. It really is what our patients feel they're ready for. And there's lots of different models to treat people back in the old days and really still now. There's incarceration is an option. There's legal models of care. There's traditional therapy and spiritual, like 12-step programs. There's medical models and collaborative models, but recovery is not linear. So patients may get better and then there might be some tremendous stress that's going on and there can be a relapse. So we try to use motivation. We use empathy and partnership in a non-judgmental way. And we know that there's going to be ambivalence about getting better and that that's normal. I think people go through different stages of recovery. They think about it and maybe prepare to go, and then they take action and dive in and get treatment and hopefully get to that point of remission and maintenance and stay there. But it requires a team. It requires family involvement, support system, whatever works. If it's spiritual, if it's the community, and we try to make sure that we individualize and tailor that. So to your question, how do we know people are improving? I mean, it's a great question. There's no like measurement for that because we know that it's not linear and we want to really just keep motivating. If they stay motivated and they're still working on things and they are engaged and honest, I guess that would be the, how I would know.
So as a follow-on then, how do you make adjustments, that individualization, that tailoring to the treatment plan if the patient is not meeting their goals since it is individual?
Yeah, so, I mean, that would be done in partnership. If someone is in an outpatient setting and perhaps getting, we have medications now, fortunately, that we use for opiate dependence. And if someone is feeling an urgency to go out and use, or there's a stressor going on and they're feeling triggered, we might step up the visits. We might have some phone calls. We might add more community support, or there's residential treatment where people can go for longer periods of time. So it depends, but again, it's very individualized. There's really no cookie cutter approach. I mean, every human being is different, different support systems, different response to medication. So we just try to really create a program that is driven by the patient themselves, truly. And then we're there to support, facilitate, and really motivate.
Great. You mentioned this briefly earlier on, Dr. Lane, but can you elaborate a little more on the role and importance of peer support in recovery?
Yes, peers are really wonderful. They themselves have been in recovery, are in recovery, have true lived experiences, and they're successful. So they have these core competencies that someone who hasn't lived through recovery may not have. I can read it in a book and I can train and have all those experiences, but these are real lived experiences and folks who have done recovery successfully. So there are certifications that are required when they come and work for us, but they can go into the emergency room, they can talk to patients, they run groups, they help set goals and teach folks how to develop coping skills. What happens when there's a stress? I can't reach for a substance. I can't go have a drink. I can't hang out in a bar with my friends. What are some coping skills I can try? And the peers really know because they've lived it. They know what works for them, and they share openly and honestly what might be helpful. And they know what the feelings are that are coming up for people that are going through recovery. So we are very fortunate to have this program and to be able to expand it. I think it makes a huge difference in recovery.
Hey, Dr. Lang, this is Terry. Again, thank you so much for joining us today. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
It is certainly a challenge to manage your treatments for substance use disorder. And up there with that difficulty is to communicate these programs throughout the community. Any comments on how ANOVA does, in fact, communicate these services? And specifically, are there any added steps that you might use to address traditionally underserved communities?
We serve all of Northern Virginia across the Eastern region, the Western and Central regions. So we serve everyone and oftentimes see people through urgent care, through the emergency departments, through our clinics, primary care, women's. People come in to have babies. So really the first entry into getting treatment for anyone, including underserved populations, is that screening. So the ESPERT screening allows us to identify someone that needs help. And then if a peer can meet them or an emergency room provider, we can attempt to engage people in that sort of care. But really any door that someone might go through, we have our community clinics across Northern Virginia also, ANOVA Cares. And there are clinics that provide different languages, therapy in different languages. We have a Pride clinic. So there's lots of different opportunities to engage. And I think certainly we're seeing more and more as we have a very diverse population here in Northern Virginia, we're seeing more need to address everyone and consider screening as the first step, because people don't always come and say, I need help. So screening helps us identify and then say, do you need help? And ask the question. If you don't ask the question, you may not know that somebody is struggling with a substance use disorder.
All right. Well, thank you. I know that you've treated many, many hundreds, if not thousands, of patients, and I'm sure each of those are very thankful for your support. Is there a patient who had to deal with both substance use disorder and depression and was successful with the treatment that perhaps stands out in your mind?
You know, I do. There's one young woman many, many years ago who came in using heroin. She was pregnant. And so she's pregnant. She's using heroin. She's living with her mother-in-law and really struggling with depression, guilt, and wanting to get off heroin, but not able to. And a lot of judgment from people, too. You're carrying this baby. How could you do this? We were able to collaborate with our OB partners. So every time she came in for an OB appointment, she also came in for a substance appointment, a recovery appointment. And we got her on buprenorphine, which is the medicine that we use to help people get off of opiates and stay off of them. So over time, she got off of heroin. She got on buprenorphine. She saw her OB. We allowed her to know that there's not going to be judgment. We're not going to take your baby away, which is a big fear that women have. And we're going to help you. She continued. She stayed with it. She had great family support, and she delivered a normal, healthy baby and brought her baby in with her to see me for follow-up appointments. And it was just the most incredible experience to see her with this beautiful baby, clean and sober, healthy, both of them healthy. That was really a highlight of my career. And I just encourage people to know that that option is there. Great memory.
That's a remarkable story. I've got to admit, I'm touched to hear that. And it definitely brings home the humanness of your discipline and all the good work that Inova does throughout our community. Another great area that Inova has done is the introduction of digital innovations such as MyChart. So people can, from their cell phone, from their laptop, get updates on just about anything that's impacting their appointments and the history of their medical support. In these new areas of artificial intelligence and machine learning, do you see a role for those technologies within substance use disorder treatment, or are you already starting to use those technologies?
You know, it's still in the early stages using AI, artificial intelligence, to predict things like relapse or to prevent a crisis. But there are apps that people can access that will connect to resources in real time. So if someone is in a crisis, there's people on the other side who will speak virtually. There's chat bots. There are apps that are centered around alcohol use. There's apps that will match people to their needs and help them during recovery. So really, it's still early, but I think the digital space and apps are very accessible. We haven't gotten to the point where we can sort of predict, you know, when someone is going to feel depressed or get triggered or have a relapse. But I think it's not that far off. And it will help with the access, because as you asked earlier, what happens to the people that are not getting care? This will help to improve access to care.
Wonderful. So what insights or recommendations can you make to treatment centers in general to help them better connect with the large population of individuals who remain untreated for substance use disorder?
I mean, really, it's the stigma. We need to just eliminate the stigma of mental health and substance use and seeking treatment for it, and help our communities to guide people into treatment, whether it's through the church or a faith-based organization or local community centers, schools. I think it's better. I do see that in this post-COVID era, there's a reduction in stigma, and the new generation of people are more open about talking and asking for help. So I think I see more treatment centers popping up. We need to make sure that we create access, that they're affordable. Some are more affordable than others, and we need to make sure the quality is excellent and we offer an evidence-based approach, care model that will get people to recovery. And
got it. Good. That's some excellent advice. So, final question. I noted in many of your articles that you have an inspirational and profound motto: be the change you wish to see in the world. I love it. It's really impactful to hear that. But what message do you hope is received by our listeners once they have heard this motto?
You know, that motto was originated by Gandhi back in 1913, and it's not exactly what Gandhi said, but it's sort of an interpretation. And it was really about if we are able to change, if we transform ourselves, then those around us will experience us differently and they will change. And there's that paying it forward kind of experience, that if I reflect on my behavior and take action and think about what I can control, then other people will be impacted by that and perhaps want to change and transform too. So it's being a part of changing the world, making the world a better place, even if it's just one tiny thing, it matters. So I think we all help each other. There's the neighborly kind of mindset that we have is important in helping each other get to just talking. I mean, when you talk to a neighbor and you spend a few minutes and then you walk away, you feel better. You feel like a sense of uplifting that comes with that conversation, because it's just, you know, you've just learned something about someone and they've learned about you. So I think that's pretty much my hope, is to be able to make a small dent and small change and help people feel better.
Well, Dr. Lang, we really appreciate your time today. Cindy and I have been positively impacted and uplifted by your comments, and we say that sincerely. And again, thank you for all your years of service to the various communities or where you work. I know you've worked very, very hard and very tirelessly for your academic pursuits, and then working through organizations, small, large, and medium-sized, to help number of people, which obviously you have. And again, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's really an honor. Thank you so much for the opportunity.